You're listening to the Politics in Action Report at CGMQ 88.9 FM. I'm bringing you the latest dish on current political news. On this segment, some opposition to Quebec's oil project in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, the Conservatives score another seat in Quebec in a recent by-election, renovations on Parliament Hill. Also, Canada's most dangerous cities, according to Maclean's, and the Canadian North will offer its first university in the Yukon by 2020. Since Quebec's oil searching project in the Gulf St. Lawrence was dismantled, opposition groups are wasting no time in the moment of stallation to protest the continuation of the Old Harry project. This project does hold the necessary licenses to pursue from both the Newfoundland and the Quebec governments, and is currently being put on hold for the reason of undergoing additional environmental assessments. This, in part, comes from the various indigenous groups settled within the region, which the project parties have to consult in order to continue with said project. Indigenous bands have called for clarity in terms of the environmental impact from undergoing this project, as the impacts are uncertain. While the project does not seem to be in pursuit, Indigenous groups settled around the Gulf will continue to take action to prevent the destruction to what they assert is their natural way of living. Specifically, testing and drilling for oil has several impacts on the marine ecosystem. First, the application of sound waves for seismic testing can disorient whales, lobster, crab, and fish and disturb their natural way of living. Secondly, if oil is found, it will take much more energy to extract the oil than actually consuming the oil itself. Thirdly, considering the St. Lawrence is already greatly polluted, I do not see why this project outweighs the cost of destroying the ecosystem. As I'm increasingly finding myself an environmentalist, I do support the Indigenous groups for the reason that the St. Lawrence is already heavily polluted and we need to move away from extracting oil for energy purposes and instead find sustainable alternative energy projects. In any scenario where we are to extract oil from the environment, it takes that much more effort and a greater impact on the environment to extract it than when we consume it. So the less we pursue oil, the better, and dismantling this project would serve the environment better, no less, protect the Indigenous people's interests. So the Indigenous populations are essentially the voices for the environment, because they are typically always on the side that seeks to protect the environment. This is due to their personal connection to the land, and they still rely on the environment for their way of living. For instance, Tanya Burnaby, executive director of the Mi'kma'wi Secretariat, stated that our lives revolve around the cycles of the ocean. We still live off what the water brings us. The dismantling of the project definitely gives time for Indigenous peoples to advocate and ensure their side of the story is heard. I best recommend we as Canadians listen to it, because it is often the side we seldom listen to. I think we should take example of how Indigenous groups perceive the environment, which is an essential part of everyday life, which is something we have taken for granted, as the environment is an essential part to our existence. The Conservative Party of Canada now has an additional seat added to its 96-seat accumulation from the federal election of 2015. The riding of Chicoutimi-le-Faujolle voted in Conservative candidate Richard Martel. Martel replaced the former holder of the riding, Denis Lemieux, a Liberal Member of Parliament, who had resigned from his position as Member of Parliament for the riding recently. Martel had the advantage of being a well-recognized local, which voters greatly appeal to when electing a particular candidate. It has also been reported that Martel had begun campaigning well before the other candidates, which granted him the advantage of recognition. Despite what headlines say that this was formerly a conservative riding and that the Tories have taken back the riding, this wasn't exactly the case. According to election results data, the last time the Conservatives held this riding was back in the years 1997 and 2000. Since then, it has been a toss-up between the Liberals, the NDP, and the Bloc Québécois that have held this riding. So I wouldn't exactly say that this was recently the Conservative riding. It was the Conservative riding once upon a time. So if anything, this tells us that this riding is anyone's or any party's game in the upcoming 2019 federal election. So what does this tell us about the next federal election? It looks as though voters are already shifting to the Conservative Party. It does look as though the Conservatives have a fighting chance in the next federal election, which is a great cause for concern for the rival Liberals, who have a broad base of support in Quebec. The Bloc Québécois seldom retained enough votes in this riding alone to have been a main competitor in this by-election. To consider the contrast in electoral support today, let's reflect back to the election of 2015. The riding was taken by the Liberals by a slim margin at 31% of the vote, with the NDP trailing behind at 29.7%, so it was a really close call for the Liberals and the NDP. While the Bloc Québécois was at 20%, and the Conservatives were at 16%, so now there has been a complete 360 flip, where now the Conservatives are on top, and the Bloc Québécois is practically non-existent in electoral support in this riding. The Conservatives did gain a lot more momentum with the fallout of the Bloc Québécois. This was in part due to the fact that the Conservatives are working very hard in campaigning in Quebec and swooping up former Bloc supporters. Much of the Conservatives' policies are appealing to Quebecers because of given circumstances. For example, the great influx of refugees in Quebec is a concern for some Quebecers, and Scheer is campaigning on the promise to be stricter and crack down on set border influx. Typically, Conservatives have a more firm stance on immigration, while Liberals typically tolerate higher levels of immigration. So what matters now for Quebecers is control rather than compromise. The riding is the center of one of Canada's aluminum and steel industries. But to me, this really didn't make a difference in selecting a party preference for this by-election. And the reason for this is because all Canadians have stood behind Trudeau in the entire NAFTA trade dispute. And when Canada is dealing with international issues, Canada as a whole stands together regardless of ideological differences. And truthful, it wouldn't matter which party was in power. Whether it was Andrew Scheer or Thomas Mulcair dealing with Trump, all Canadians would be behind the Prime Minister. In other words, no one would disagree the American President is being unreasonable, and Justin Trudeau has maintained a level of professionalism and diplomatic etiquette. So this really wasn't that much of a factor attributing to the Conservatives' victory in this recent by-election. What might have been was the whole debate regarding Canada's dairy supply management. While I am not certain there are actual farmers in the region, perhaps there are, whether people are farmers or not, most Quebecers share Andrew Scheer's stance on maintaining the current dairy system as it is. Recall that Maxime Bernier, who was removed from shadow cabinet last week, was in favor of eliminating Canada's dairy supply management, which does not sit well for Quebec farmers who rely on this system for an income and a living. Now Quebecers have the confidence, from Scheer's removal of Bernier from the shadow cabinet, that the Conservative Party stands in support for this system, and this was a major seller for Quebecers. And it helps that the Conservatives have been campaigning in Quebec and drilling these messages forward. So this puts the Conservatives well ahead of the campaigning game, well ahead of the 2019 federal election. So Conservatives have a lot to offer to Quebecers, and this is what is giving them the votes. The question is, what are the other party candidates willing to offer? Major renovations are occurring on Parliament Hill that will see federal members of Parliament sitting in a new glass ceiling and woodsy-inspired House of Commons design. The new location of the House of Commons is located in the West Block and costs an estimated $863 million in renovations. The current sitting House of Commons is located in the center block. Once vacant, sitting members of Parliament will hold sessions in the West Block while the center gets renovations. This will cost an estimated $4.7 billion as granted by the Treasury Board, and will take 10 years to construct. The Parliament buildings hold a lot of history. Constructed in 1866, a year prior Confederation, these buildings were home to lawmakers and the various past governments of our country. The Parliament buildings have not been renovated since 1916, when a fire had burnt most of the buildings except the library, so it has been about 100 years since any renovations were done. I would like to discuss how Ottawa became the capital city that it is today, and this all came from royal decree that the once town would be Canada's capital. When deliberations were ongoing for Canadian Confederation, the Founding Fathers also had Canada's permanent capital on the discussion table. British North America, which was what Canada was called prior Confederation, had two temporary capitals that the Founding Fathers traveled to back and forth, which were Toronto and Quebec City. It came to a great surprise to the Founding Fathers when Queen Victoria selected none of these cities to be capital, but a town in between, known today as Ottawa. The Public Works Commissioner and the Governor General at the time, Sir Edmund Walker Head, decided to go with the Gothic Revival style as they thought it would best represent the parliamentary democracy that Canada would be. With recent planned renovations, Canadians could only guess what elements of our country will be maintained and reflective in our future House of Commons. And I'm sure I'm just as anxious as other Canadians to see what these renovations will bring to Parliament Hill. Do you feel safe in your city? Some cities have a reputation to have shady areas, perhaps a dark alley or two, but actual crime statistics can indicate the prevalence of crime in a given city. Maclean's magazine has listed the top most dangerous cities in Canada, and this is based on the amount of variety of crimes that take place within a city itself and the rate by which they occur. So which Canadian city tops the list as the most dangerous? The city of North Battleford, Saskatchewan, takes the cake as Canada's most dangerous city. These statistics are taken from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, and are based off of the Crime Severity Index that accounts for volume and the severity of offenses. What these statistics indicate is that crime in North Battleford is up with a crime severity rate of 353, the largest in Canada. While there were zero reported homicides for this year, where the city ranks in crime is with high assault rates, sexual assault, breaking and entering, fraud, and impaired driving. What I will comment in regards to the high crime rate is that it is likely involved with the tensions between the Indigenous population and the other Canadians within the region. There are approximately 7 or 9 Indigenous reserves around the city, which makes for a high rate of altercations between the two cultures in one shared space. The second ranking on the list is Thompson, Manitoba. Prince Albert, Saskatchewan gets the third spot. Williams Lake, BC in fourth. And Red Deer, Alberta ranked 5th dangerous among the Canadian cities. So it appears the top 10 dangerous cities in Canada reside within Western Canada. While these cities do not hold the largest population densities, there are other factors that attribute to the high levels of crime. Among factors that can contribute to high levels of crime is the lack of availability of affordable housing, minimal employment opportunities, and cultural tensions, and for other possible reasons. Poverty crime has been on the rise in Canada in recent years, and as the cost of living keeps rising, I do attribute the majority of crimes committed to be relative to poverty levels. As such, there is a correlation between the attributes I mentioned above and the rates of crime in Canadian cities. You might be wondering, where does the city of Sherbrooke rank among this list? The city of Sherbrooke actually rests at 153rd spot among the list, with the highest incident of crime being breaking and entering. Given Sherbrooke is far down the list, and the most prevalent crime occurring in the city is robbery, it is a relatively safe city when compared to the other cities. So maybe this list does not tell us so much as which Canadian cities are maybe the most dangerous, but rather which cities see the greatest prevalence of crime. The prevalence of crime has a lot to do with what is in and around the city and the various ethnicities within the localities. Consider the example of North Battleford, Saskatchewan, where there are Indigenous reserves around the city, so cultural tensions are inevitable and assault crimes are likely to occur. Nonetheless, the list will deter people from moving to a given location if they happen to search a Canadian city and this list is a result among the search. They might think twice about locating to the city. This next news piece, while not political specifically, I thought it would be a newsworthy story to discuss. The Canadian University Guide will need to add an additional university to the list. By 2020, Yukon College, located in Whitehorse, Yukon, plans to have university status and offer university degrees for prospective students. This would make the first university to be located in the Canadian North, as all existing universities reside in the southern portion of Canada. Now, Canada will provide prospective students with the option to study in the Canadian North, which expands on the Canadian experience, and it is about time. The territory expects the Yukon University Act to become law sometime in 2019 or 2020. The soon-to-be university will also receive governmental grants to kickstart the transition into a university. In the meantime, the Willby University will offer its first bachelor's degree in Indigenous governance for the fall of this year. Not only does the college aspire to be a university, but also to be what is called a hybrid university, which means the university will offer both college and university degrees. The college is renowned for hosting events centered on Indigenous culture, and as a result, had received the top award for excellence in Indigenous education in 2015 from Colleges and Institutes Canada. So by becoming a university, this also grants Canadians, as well as international students, the opportunity to get the feel of the Northern culture, as well as the Indigenous culture present in the North. What this tells us is that the Canadian educational field is expanding, and this parallels with an increasing interest for international students to attend Canadian universities. Not only can Canada generate greater revenue by having another university, but people can gain a sense of what Canada's true north has to offer. You have listened to another segment of Politics in Action. I hope to see you the next time. I'm Emily at CJMQ 88.9 FM.